Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're going to have a look first at American geopolitics briefly in the interwar years, and then we're going to start on World War II. And last time we were looking at the Germans, and we then talked about the Americans and the impact of World War I in leading America to abandon its long-term distance from European power politics. But I think it's fair to say that this intervention in World War I in 1917 and Woodrow Wilson's subsequent plans for a League of Nations as part of an ambitious peace settlement in turn became a liberal universalism that was widely discredited in America. And this is interesting because it's a reminder to us, should be a reminder to us, that we shouldn't assume that there is some automatic favor for interventionism within American psyche, strategic geography, collective politics, or any combination of nouns and adjectives one chooses to throw together. I think it's also worth pointing out that the geopolitics of the 1920s in America extended very much to the domestic sphere. There were Republican administrations in 1921 to 1933, and they showed or displayed a fairly consistent xenophobia, or at least concern, seen, for example, in worries about international left-wing tendencies, particularly what was referred to as Bolshevism, and in persistent and strong moves to limit immigration. So there was a social politics of whatever one might call disengagement, of opposition to the outside, that was related to the politics of geopolitics, if one wishes to use that term. And one shouldn't keep these separate. International relations didn't sit in a separate dimension. And again, the comparison with the present day is interesting. We can discuss the extent to which the Republican administration in waiting, which is how President Trump sees himself, or ex-President Trump, and that of some of his other Republican contestants, is more motivated by a set of domestic engagements and attitudes, but they appear to carry with them attitudes towards intervention abroad and membership in multilateral organizations. In the case of the 1920s, there was a degree of the development of what one might call, it using a later phrase, the national security state, not least the establishment of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. Moves to limit immigration were an important aspect of the geopolitics of the period, one that tends to be underplayed by the standard emphasis on geopolitics as territory. And I think that needs to be considered. And one of the ways in which a lot of the current language about geopolitics is very poor is that most of it focuses on territory and not on population. Indeed, the geopolitics of migration are an important issue, with immigration measures in part a key aspect of territorial control, and one that becomes more significant across the world from the 1870s, in part leading to what one might say is the present situation, which is a segmentation of migration systems. Now, I would argue that much conventional discussion of geopolitics is apt to downplay, if not ignore, immigration. And this is a top-down approach which fails to capture the significance of population flows for, as it were, the apocryphal man on the street. Another aspect of the demographics of geopolitics was provided by the classification of population, which became much more common through categorization, censuses, notions of inferior races, eugenicist ideas, and the politics of birth control. Indeed, all of those could be seen fairly widely in the 1920s, with a sort of age of nationalist imperialism, if you like, in which was one which the nation was seen as an ethnic identity, most particularly, of course, for Germany and Japan, also seen in WASP notions of America with hostility to immigration, particularly to immigration then from Catholics in Southern Europe. And what is interesting is the extent to which both Britain and France, although imperial powers, had a more liberal interpretation of national imperialism. Now, American internationalism was to revive from the very end of the 1930s. And essentially, and again, it might be instructive to consider the present situation, essentially, this was a crisis response. Clearly, there had been internationalists right through the 20s and 30s, but they'd had relatively little traction. And indeed, whatever Roosevelt's personal preferences, and Roosevelt liked playing a Sphinx-like approach and was also fundamentally dishonest, however admirable his subsequent stance might appear in World War II, but the internationalists were at bay for most of the 30s. But 1940, provoked by the fears aroused by the German takeover of the European Atlantic coast from the northern Cape of Norway to the Pyrenees, the French-Spanish border, and provoked also by the apparent imminence of the fall of Britain, America began to see that the Atlantic was not necessarily a benign space, instead of which it might be a route for invasion or at least pressure from Germany. And this led to a rapid American military buildup, especially of the Navy, and to the provision of supplies to Britain, notably through Lend-Lease, which was a key extension of geopolitical commitment. And American war games, prior to the outbreak of America's entry into World War II, were increasingly ambitious in terms of the units deployed. For example, the Louisiana exercises, in which both Eisenhower and Patton took place, were in practice designed for conflict against an army like that of Germany. In large part, Lend-Lease supplies were an aspect of a forward buffer nature of geopolitics, one that can be seen today, one could argue, with the provision of aid to Ukraine by both America and your other European countries, and also American provision of aid to Taiwan. Such a stance, however, can risk limiting the geopolitical options for the aiding power, as it could be argued happened to America in the Middle East from the 1960s with its assistance to Israel. I'm not saying there was anything wrong about the assistance to Israel. I'm simply saying that it affected American options in the Middle East. In the case of 1940, anxiety turning to fear played a major role in the response to German and Japanese success. Now, in practice, Hitler remained focused on Europe and the Japanese on China, but there was still the danger that their successes would lead to oceanic adventurism and expansionism, as indeed was to be the case for Japan in 1942. Indeed, should it occur, taking control over the possessions of Denmark, the Netherlands, France, and Britain would provide Germany with a series of Atlantic bases, and Japan the same for the Pacific. And this was a dynamic situation, as shown in particular by the fate of Iceland in 1940. Iceland was a Danish colony. There was sympathy for Germany there. The Germans had had warships visit Iceland in the 30s, and it was anticipated that Germany might try and establish it as a base from which it could use air and naval units to, as it were, cut transatlantic routes to Britain. And British action, well, I say British, Canadian forces were very important, but British imperial action precluded that of Germany and thus ensured that Greenland was too far for the Germans to do much about, though they did actually take some submarine-born meteorologists to establish secret bases or secret stations on the east coast of Greenland. There was also in America propaganda emphasizing the necessity to be forward acting in order to ensure security. Henry Luce, the publisher of Time, Life and Fortune magazines, which gave him the dominance of the Colour magazine monthly weekly situation, offered warnings supported by maps by the innovative cartographer Richard Eads Harrison, on whom there's excellent work by the American scholar Susan Shulton. Harrison's three approaches to the US illustrated an article in Fortune in September 1940 about the readiness of the American military, asking, "Our line of minimum physical security stretches from Alaska to the Galapagos, from Greenland to the Amazon Valley. Have we the with what to hold it?" In practice, the suggestions in this article and in many other geopolitical speculations were somewhat fanciful, for cartography can lead to the abandonment of prudential considerations such as scale, terrain, logistics, and other aspects of feasibility. For example, the map in this issue of Fortune from Berlin, in other words, indicating the approach to America from Berlin, was extraordinary. The accompanying text declaring, quote, "A great circle route from Berlin here passes through Detroit. The fanciful can see, if they wish, a pincers movement extending from Newfoundland down the New England coast and down the St. Lawrence to the continent's heart. A third arm reaching to the south shore of Hudson Bay, where the terrain permits quick construction of landing fields. And there is no east-west highway north of the Great Lakes." Well, quite frankly, the Germans were in no position to do that, and that was extraordinarily fanciful by anybody's standards. The approach map from Tokyo foregrounded Alaska, adding a text in which, instead of determinism, distance was discussed in terms of attitudes and human responses. Quote, "The direct line from most Asiatic ports approaches the US from this angle. The coastal valleys seem temptingly remote from the US center of population, 2,000 miles away across mountains, badlands, and plains. But the map does not reckon with a transportation system that could put a fully equipped army of 500,000 men into Seattle in a matter of days, if we had the army." And of course, the corollary of that is if Japanese get 500,000 men into Seattle, it's a threat to America. Well, you need to stop there and then think, well, how on earth were the Japanese supposed to get 500,000 men into Seattle? I mean, even 50,000 would have been logistically a nightmare. There was no mention of the fact that Japan, while able to threaten the Aleutians and Hawaii, and actually briefly taking some islands in the Western Aleutians, lacked the lift and logistical system to transport a large army to the continental America. Japan was far more of a threat in this respect than North Vietnam during the Vietnam War. There was no chance of a North Vietnamese army landing at Santa Monica, but there were still major issues of practicality. This point is more generally true of much geopolitical discussion, and is one of the reasons why I think the popular books, as I've already indicated, for example, Tim Marshall's books, are really actively unhelpful. They appear without any real understanding of issues of feasibility or practicality. In particular, logistics is a major problem for the deployment and projection of power, but one that has been consistently underplayed, not least with Mackinder's confidence, which we've already discussed, about the relative ease with which rail could link the parts of Eurasia. Harrison's map from Caracas was more menacing as it more readily presented much of America as under threat. The text brought in economics. Quote, if an enemy should ever establish himself on the northern shore of South America, that's Venezuela or part of the shore of Colombia, or in the mazes of the West Indies, he would, that's a very emotive word, suggesting sort of evil and deviousness. He would first cut at the US G-string, the Panama Canal, then rip at the south soft belly here displayed. For the Gulf Coast, that's the Gulf of Mexico, with oil, salt, sulfur, coal, and gas, is becoming a great chemical stew pot, nourishing, shaping, and extending industry, a modern analogue to the earlier iron ore economy of the Great Lakes. Well, yeah, you could argue that. But in practice, the plans of the German Kriegsmarine, the Navy, focused on a transatlantic attack using Spanish and Portuguese island territories, the Canaries and Azores as bases, and drawing for this on the support of their right-wing regimes. Moreover, the theme of target selection as a motivator for strategy and a director of geopolitics, alleged, ensured that Chesapeake Bay, with the Atlantic Fleet base at Norfolk, appeared the prime target for the Germans. It's worth bearing in mind that, yes, there was to be submarine attacks in the Happy Time in the Caribbean on the Americans, both on their coastal movements along the Gulf of Mexico, around Florida and up the East Coast, and also on the movement of oil from Venezuela to the United States. But that was precisely it. Submarines were a secondary military means. Focused on Britain, but with an obvious relevance for America, the Kriegsmarine had developed a sort of Weltpolitik that enabled it to think in terms of power projection into the Atlantic and as far as South America. But the Kriegsmarine was not central to his goals, to Hitler's goals, no more than regaining German overseas colonies lost in World War I, such as Togo, Cameroon, Southwest Africa, and Tanganyika. The geopolitics, if you like, was very different. And the Kriegsmarine's interest in the establishment of bases around the Atlantic and in the Indian Ocean was scarcely credible, which, of course, underlines the extent to which a geopolitics of fear, as in E. Harrison's maps, was also quite extraordinary. As a reminder that geopolitics as space was of scant offensive meaning without significant presence, the Bismarck, the most powerful German warship, sailed into the North Atlantic in May 1941, supported only by a heavy cruiser. Well, there were some oilers, but a heavy cruiser. And the Bismarck was sunk as a result of a massive concentration of British naval power. Subsequently, the withdrawal in February 42 of major German warships from Brest, particularly the Scharnhorst and the Neisenauer, lessened the threat posed by these warships to the Allied position in the North Atlantic, and thus their potential danger as a fleet in being. If you want, that was the geostrategic reality, whatever might be the geopolitical rhetoric. Instead, the warships, the German warships, were concentrated in Norwegian waters, as was the Tirpitz, and thereby subordinated to the army's goals by being used to threaten Allied maritime shipping routes to the Soviet Union. Now, this was a plausible goal, given Anglo-American surface strength in the North Atlantic, but also an indication of the compromising thereby of the ability to what Germany had to control the coastline. Indeed, what one could argue is that, yes, the coastline gave the Atlantic coastline it had seized gave the Germans opportunities, but these opportunities were greatly lessened, as I've mentioned, by the actual strength of the British and American navies, their surface strength in the North Atlantic. Secondly, their ability to develop effective anti-submarine techniques, practices, and resources. And indeed, the Atlantic coast of France became essentially a defensive obligation for Germany. So what you might present as a geopolitical fact, i.e. we control this coastline, can have very different geostrategic consequences, indeed rationales. It can be one of power projection, it can be one of vulnerability. There was also a time sequencing to bring into the geopolitical equation. Submarine attacks, as used by the Germans, require scale, method, organization, maintenance, intelligence, and luck in order to stand a chance in confronting anti-submarine warfare and thereby creating a blockade. Moreover, as the German naval leadership appreciated, the submarine campaign was a long war tool, rather like air offensives prior to the unexpected use by the Americans of the atom bomb. Now, long war puts an emphasis on energy availability, which was a key element, one encouraging states to try to mold circumstances that were very much spatially encoded in the sense of the location of supplies and routes. And that, if you like, if you wish to use the term geopolitics, you could use geoeconomics, it is an element that's important as it remains important to the present day. Where you get your energy resources, energy availability from, and what the consequences of this availability and the constraints in it are. So, for example, Italy, the third power of the Axis, Mussolini wouldn't have seen himself in that role, Italy was short of oil and coal and had only a limited industrial base. It's a good book on Italy in World War II by McGregor Knox on that. There's also good stuff, of course, by John Gooch. As a result, the geopolitical potential, or geostrategic potential, of an empire that included the Dodecanese, that's the islands around Rhodes, Libya, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and most of modern Somalia, was far less than any map might suggest. The Italians also lacked an effective naval air arm, and their ability to challenge the Mediterranean axis of the British Navy was to be dependent on the German aircraft deployed in Sicily from January 1941. As another instance of the difficulties of judging from maps, or if you wish to use the term maps as a palimpsest for geography, of the difficulties of judging from geography, Admiral Andrew Cunningham, the able British naval commander in the Mediterranean, feared in May 1941 that the Germans might press on from capturing Crete, which they had just done by airborne assault, to invade Cyprus, also British held, and then to deploy forces in Vichy-run Syria, threatening the entire British position in the Middle East. In the event such goals were not pursued by a German military focused on the forthcoming attack on the Soviet Union, but nor were they really practical. There was a limit to the airlift capability the Germans had, and in the Crete operation, they'd all had experienced heavy casualties among their parachute and glider-borne forces, and including among the gliders, and had also suffered heavily at the hands of the Royal Navy, albeit it suffering as well. Similarly, there was a prioritization in American geopolitics, one that was not dictated by geography. Concerned that Britain might collapse helped Roosevelt settle pre-war, in the event of war, on a Germany first strategy focused on an American invasion of continental Europe, and indeed of Britain if Britain fell. That commitment underlined the prior significance of securing the safety of Atlantic shipping lanes. Now, this was and remains a controversial choice among American commentators, one linked to a tendency, as a result of the focus on the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in December 41, to forget that Germany swiftly afterwards declared war on America, on which there's an interesting book by Klaus Schmiedner, or not to treat that declaration as what amounted to a real threat. In reality, in early 42, more German than Japanese submarines were in American coastal waters mounting attacks. Moreover, these attacks were more significant in their damage to the American war economy, notably to the coastal movement of oil. Anti-submarine warfare in the Atlantic made island bases especially important, notably those of Iceland and the Azores, as well as Caribbean bases and those in Brazil. So the American logic was clear. Germany, the stronger adversary, and therefore with the more globally ambitious ideology, had a greater potential than Japan to overthrow its opponents, Britain and the Soviet Union, as well as to intervene in South America against American interests. In contrast, Japan was faced by the far greater distances of the Pacific, much larger than the Atlantic, and was not able to draw on an economy comparable to that of German-run Europe. The Japanese Navy could only achieve so much. Although colonies such as Malaya, British, and the Philippines, American, might be conquered, Britain and America were far less vulnerable to Japanese power. Now, what I want to do is to press on with World War II and to look at the role of perception and assessment. But I wonder, Graham, if you've got any questions or points at the moment, not about World War II, but about American geopolitics in the years up to World War II.
Well, thank you, Jeremy. One thing that occurs to me as you're discussing plans and perceptions of what the Germans and the Japanese might feasibly or infeasibly have been able to do to the United States is the question of how far American geopolitical thinkers were engaged by what Russia might be able to do, whether you know, crossing over from Siberia to Alaska or using any of their Pacific bases to harass American communications. Was there a great interest in the threat from Russian Bolshevism at a geopolitical level, or were the Americans actually clear-sighted in the sense that Axis powers were more likely to be the coming menace?
Well, I think that's a fascinating question. There had, as you know, been great concern about the Soviets at the 1919-2021. You've got American troops sent into Russia, particularly into the Russian Far East and indeed also the Russian White Sea. And you've got concern about what appears to be Bolshevism among American workers, labor disputes, fear about striking dockers at Seattle, stopping the American war effort against Russia, the American military drawing up White War Plan White, which was a war plan to deal with insurrection within the United States, which is aimed at Bolsheviks, and also obviously a number of trials in the 1920s focused on Bolshevism. I think it's fair to say that although, I mean, under the Republicans, you would not be surprised, but also under the Democrats, there was no particular lessening of a dislike of the Soviet Union, though I think it's also fair to say that some of the Democrats, and Roosevelt in particular, though not only him, never really understood how malign Stalin was. But nevertheless, the Soviet Union did not appear to American military planners in the late 20s and 30s to be the threat posed by Japan. Now, this is interesting because the Soviets, as I pointed out in my book on air power, built up actually quite an impressive long-range air force in the early 30s. It was designed for war against Japan. And the Soviets were interested in Navy build-up. I mean, Stalin in particular in the 30s wanted battleships. He, like Hitler, had an obsession with battleships. But the practicality was this. The Soviet Union did not build up a large navy, partly because a navy is a more sophisticated military infrastructure than an army, and the brutality of Stalin in the purges did not lend itself to appropriate organizational and construction methods, partly because, as I discussed in my book on naval power, the Soviets moved between naval strategies of deep water projection and others which focused on essentially helping the army in any conflict along the shores of the Baltic. And there were big differences within the Navy about this, partly generational, partly factional, and of course you won't be surprised to hear in the age of Stalin, accompanied by the execution of those who didn't, as it were, do particularly well. Now, the contrast with Japan is obvious. Japan has the third largest navy in the world. Japan has aircraft carriers. Japan has impressive battleships. Japan has bases in the Pacific. So quite frankly, if you were an American naval planner, you were not particularly focused on the Soviet Union. You were focused on Japan. And although, of course, actually, the Soviet Union was very close to America in the shape of the Bering Straits between Siberia and Alaska being quite modest. Nevertheless, there was not, shall we say, the security of Alaska as at the forefront of American strategic concerns. So I think it's fair to say that the Americans in the late 20s and 30s were less troubled by a geostrategic threat from the Soviet Union than Britain was. I mean, Britain was worried about Soviet influence and intervention in Afghanistan. They were worried about Soviet inclinations towards Iran, where the British had interests. They were worried about Soviet subversion in India. They were worried about the Soviets' links with the communists in China. So the British were more concerned about the Soviet Union than they were concerned about Japan, I would suggest, in the 20s. Though in the 30s, they take a different position when the Manchuria crisis sees Japan from 31 become more aggressive vis-a-vis China, and this lends energy to the idea of building up the Singapore naval base in order to provide a base for naval power projection against Japan into the Western Pacific.
How forward-thinking was American strategy in terms of what they would need to do to defend, if they could defend, their Pacific outposts, whether naval bases or the likes of the Philippines? Was there a view that if the Japanese attacked, these would simply be lost, either the hard way or the soft way, but they would be lost? Or was there alternative views that they could be satisfactorily resupplied by sea, that the aircraft carriers could offer sufficient support, or indeed that further little island bases should be acquired as forward positions in which to defend what America already had?
Well, that's a fascinating question. And I seem to hear you asking a question there, in fact, about Taiwan today. And I think that's a good question to ask. There is scholarship on this, incidentally, on the quite extensive scholarship on American naval planning in the 1920s and 1930s. And in particular, what could and should be done in terms of responding to the Japanese position in the Western Pacific, and whether there should be a focus on a quick advance westwards and by the fleet in order to try and relieve and support American bases, notably in the Philippines, but also, for example, Guam or Wake Island, or whether there should be a slow, and that was known as the through ticket, or whether there should be a slower approach aimed at conquering the Japanese bases in the Mariana and the Caroline Islands in the Northwest Pacific for what they'd gained from Germany. And in order and to do that prior to moving the Navy into Philippine waters, because otherwise the Navy might be attacked by shore-based aircraft and suffer heavy losses. An American fleet exercises in the 20s and 30s looked extensively at that. They also looked at the question of what should be the geographical axis of advance on Japan, an issue that's quite interesting vis-a-vis differences of opinion that were to be held in 1942, 43, and 44 about the axis that should be followed. So I think it's fair to say that the Americans were devoting a lot of attention to this, and they were aware of the problems posed by air power and the vulnerability of naval units. In practical terms, if you look at the outset of World War II, the fate of the Prince of Wales and the repulse off Malaya, and the fate of Allied naval warships in the Battle of the Java Sea, first in December, the second in, I think it's March, first in December 41, the second, I think it's in March 42, indicated very clearly this vulnerability. So the Americans were aware of that and were thoughtful of it, and American war planning was quite acute. The Japanese were also doing war planning for war with Japan, including exercises like, for example, attacking the Panama Canal. That was one of the things they considered doing. I think it's fair to say that there was a tendency to underrate the, you know, I mean, I know I'm boring on about logistics. Well, that's partly because I've written a book, a history of logistics, but partly because the size of the Pacific makes logistics a particular issue there. And I think it's fair to say that Japanese plans really lacked an intelligent logistical assessment of the situation in Pacific operations into certainly the mid Pacific, and it's still less the Eastern Pacific. The Americans, on the other hand, had some rather interesting developments during the war, particularly with fleet logistics, with warships keeping up with the fleet, acting as movable supplies. There's a very good book by W.R. Carter called Beans, Bullets, and Black Oil, the story of fleet logistics afloat in the Pacific during World War II. And it's things like that that are necessary if you want to understand the situation. And I know this might seem to you to be flogging a dead horse, but so much of the literature on geopolitics doesn't look at questions like, you know, logistical support, the strain this would pose, the amount of shipping required, whether that shipping was available, or the difference between a hypothetical range for aircraft from a given base and what the range would be in bad weather, adverse winds, carrying a heavy load of bombs, and also having to take potentially avoiding action against interceptors, which all of which, you know, to put it mildly, compromise the range. So, I mean, what I would argue is that the geostrategic situation is very significant, but it needs to be understood alongside the multiplicity of factors that affect, you know, tactical and indeed operational considerations.
Well, that's a very important note upon which to end. In the next episode, we will see how it develops with war itself. But for taking us through American geopolitical considerations in the approach to the Second World War, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.